ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 21, Text Number 19. Vishayeshu kanajhasat Pumshaha sangastato bhavet Sangdattatra bhavet karma Kamad eva kalinrinam Vishayeshu gnadhyasat Pumsha sangas tato bhavet Sangattacha bhavet karma Karma deva kalhirninam Vishayeshu gnadhyasat Pumsha sangas tato bhavet Sangatatra bhavet karma Kamadeva kalhinrinam Vishayeshu. In material objects of sense gratification, guna adhyasat, because of presuming them to be good, pumshaha, of a person, sangaha, attachment, tataha, from that presumption, bhavit, comes into being, sangat, from that material association, tatcha, thus, bhavit, arises. Karamaha, lust. Karamat, from lust. Eva, also. Kali, quarrel. Nirinam, among men. Translation. One who accepts material sense objects as desirable certainly becomes attached to them. From such attachment, lust arises, and this lust creates quarrel among men. Purport. The actual goal of human life should not be material sense gratification, for it is the basis of conflict in human society. Although the Vedic literature sometimes sanctions sense gratification, the ultimate purpose of the Vedas is renunciation. Since Vedic culture cannot possibly recommend anything that disturbs human life, a lusty person is easily angered and becomes inimical to anyone frustrating his lusty desires. Since his sex desire can never be satisfied, a lusty person ultimately becomes frustrated with his own sex partner, and thus a love-hate relationship develops. A lusty person considers himself to be the enjoyer of God's creation and is therefore full of pride and false prestige. The lusty, proud person will not be attracted to the process of humble submission to the lotus feet of the bona fide spiritual master. Attraction to illicit sex is thus the direct enemy of Krishna consciousness, which depends upon humble submission to the representative of the Supreme Lord. Lord Krishna also states in Bhagavad Gita that desire for illicit sex is the overbearing sinful enemy of this world. Because modern society sanctions unrestricted mixing of men and women, its citizens cannot possibly achieve peace. Rather, the regulation of conflict becomes the basis of social survival. This is a symptom of an ignorant society falsely accepting the material body as the highest good as described here by the words Vishayeshu Kunajasat. One who is too affectionate to his own body will inevitably be seized by sex desire. So I'll read the translation again. Vishayeshu Gunajasat Pumsa Sangastato Bhavit Sangatatra Bhavit Karamaha Karamadeva Kaliraninam. One who accepts material sense objects as desirable certainly becomes attached to them. From such attachment lust arises, and this lust creates quarrel among men. So, in this chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Explanation of the Vedic Path, Lord Krishna is describing the problems associated with those who may not be qualified for the actual, you know, Vedic processes of Kama Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Astanga Yoga, or Bhakti Yoga. Or that they're following a one of these paths, but improperly. That's another way of being unqualified, that someone is actually following the path, but they're not following it properly. So they're also unqualified. Some may follow, some may not. So he's pointing out, Lord Krishna is pointing out how they really cannot achieve success. And here, as described in the purport, of course, that many people follow religious principles sentimentally. They follow what they call Dharma. The people translate Dharma as a religious faith or a religious sentiment, but they don't know that you know, Dharma is actually a scientific process of purification, and there's no question of Dharma being some sentimental attachment to a particular faith. So for instance, someone may sentimentally accept the idea that animals have no souls, and you know, being attached to that particular faith, blind faith, therefore conclude that it is all right, it is dharmic or religious to eat animals. So one may sentimentally accept animals have no souls, but the scientific fact is that animals do have souls. So Dharma is a scientific process of purification, and there's no room for sentimental attachment to unscientific you know, processes. So the Vedas, therefore, people who have a sentimental understanding of religion, they may understand, or they may think that religion helps one in one's sense gratification. So religion is allows us to eat meat and, you know, have a good sex life and you know, have some nice wine after a meal, and you know, to gamble, just like every year in Melbourne, before they have the Melbourne Cup, they get the top priest in Melbourne to bless the race and send their blessings. That's a fact, because You know, they're considering that we'll give our blessings, everyone will be happy by gambling. So that the blessings are there. So they're thinking that, you know, the blessings are for happiness through sense gratification. So, but actually, here, Lord Krishna is describing that sense gratification is not really a part of religion at any stage. Although concessions are made, the concessions are not the goal, but ultimately even giving up the concessions for sense gratification is the goal. The real goal of religion or Dharma at any level is to purify the living entities from the propensity to enjoy the material energy. Because the whole process of enjoying the material energy means that we are situated in ignorance of our own eternal self, and we are just like a prisoner who is suffering in prison. The goal is not to enjoy prison life as much as possible. The real goal is to get out of prison. So material life is a punishment where the living entities are punished with death. You know, death is a punishment. It's not a natural part of life. The non-devotees, they consider death just, it is a natural part of life. But there's nothing natural about death. No one wants to die. Yeah. If it was so natural, why is everyone fighting to stay alive? You know, no one wants to die. No one, disease, people take it as a natural part of life, but it's not. It's a punishment. It shouldn't be there. Birth, death, old age and disease, they actually shouldn't be there. So the Vedic process is to help us to get release from the punishment and the prison of material existence by giving up the propensity to try and enjoy the material nature. The act of trying to enjoy the material nature is actually an act of envy of God. it means that rather than serving the Supreme Lord with love, according to our constitutional position, we say that we won't do, we'll do something else independently. So just like if someone acts independently of the state, it's actually unlawful. If within a family someone acts independently of the parents, it is not, you know, tolerated. So in any condition, we see that the living entity who, out of envy, chooses to give up their love for the Supreme Lord and act in a different way, then the material world facilitates that. So the idea of purification of religion is actually to give up that envy and that material desire to enjoy in the material world separately, independently, unlawfully from the Supreme Lord. So therefore, sense gratification is not, you know, getting blessings to enjoy the material world is not actual religion. So here Krishna is pointing out, destroying that conception by showing the problems associated with enjoying material desires. So he says that, you know, one who accepts material sense objects as desirable certainly becomes attached to them. And from such attachment, lust arises. So these are, this is a natural progression. That and this is also described in the Bhagavad Gita, of course. We all know that verse from the second chapter, text 62. Practically the same verse. Krishna says, Jayato Vishyan Pumsha Sangasteshu Pajayati Sangat Sanjayati Karamaha Kamakrodo Pajayati. While contemplating the objects of the senses, a person develops attachment for them, and from such attachment lust develops, and from lust anger arises. That's, you know, for all intents and purposes the same. And Krishna is actually stressing the same point, because in the previous verse, text 61, Krishna has said that one who fixes his mind on me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his intelligence is fixed. One who restrains his senses, keeping them under full control, and fixes his consciousness upon me, is known as a man of steady intelligence. In other words, that person can steadily control his mind and senses and act religiously, act piously, avoid sinful life. His intelligence is steady, his or her, because the mind is fixed on Krishna. And the same point is really being elaborated here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that the real goal of the Vedas is to fix one's mind on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, not that we're just executing so-called religious principles without any concept of God. Because if we do that, this happens. That by such artificial processes of renunciation and sense control in the name of religion, naturally, because the mind is not fixed on the supreme, on something higher, what happens is the objects of the senses, and of course, as we know, the biggest attraction in the material world for anyone is the opposite sex. So for men, their mind is always fixed on, you know, enjoying the form, beautiful form of a woman. And for the women, it is, you know, similar. Their mind is fixed on enjoying the handsome form of a man. This is the greatest attraction. So for one whose mind is not fixed upon the Supreme Lord within their religious principles, that's bound to come up within their mind. You know, somewhere or another, you know, the forms, what to speak of, you know, other modes of enjoying the material world, but especially this one is the most difficult, it will come up in one's mind. Now, as soon as it comes up in one's mind, one becomes, you know, attached to that. You know, one will perceive the beautiful form of the opposite sex, and then one's mind will become attached to that. Oh, that is so beautiful, and a desire that, oh, if I could enjoy that beautiful person like this. That is inevitable. That's just a natural process. It's not that it will, you know, there is no question that it won't happen. That's what Krishna is saying. There's no question that this will not happen. If the mind is not fixed on, you know, absolutely fixed on the Supreme Lord, there's no question that this will not happen. This is exactly what will happen, without a doubt. It is an inevitable calamity. So what happens is mind, you know, one may be performing all sorts of so-called religious activities, and the mind becomes fixed on the opposite sex, and, you know, one becomes attached to that beautiful form, and then lust, that I must enjoy at that, so that desire comes. And then You know, one becomes attached to that, then lust arises, and then from that lust, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, anger arises, and as he says here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that it creates quarrel among men. Now that anger means that anything that's going to frustrate that desire for sense gratification, to enjoy in that way that one is, you know, lusting over, attached to, one's immediately going to become angry, and that person or anyone who has somehow put an obstacle in the way of enjoying, they immediately become the enemy. They immediately become, we become angry at them, we become disturbed by them. Here he describes there that because, you know, especially sex attraction in the material world can never actually be satisfied, therefore even the relationship between a husband and wife can often, you know, end up in a love-hate relationship. Like that. So, we see that, actually, there was a documentary about President Kennedy, JFK, who was assassinated, about his, because he was considered to be literally the embodiment of goodness, you know, the perfect, most family man, and you know, the most model citizen, and you know, just the embodiment of goodness and hope for the whole country of America. What people didn't know was that he suffered like everyone else. So you would think, as a president, you have so much to lose, but still, this principle will act no matter how much responsibility one has. So we see that he had many, many different affairs, but the problem was, and those affairs were with, you know, the first affair that he had was JFK's father. He didn't have an affair with his father, but his father was a multimillionaire, and he made his millions sort of through the black market. But of course, once he became a millionaire, he became a member of high society. And but because of the black market, he was connected to the mafia. So when his son was running for president, he enlisted their help to raise the funds to get his son elected into presidency. So there was a connection. And JFK, when he was going through, I think it was just before he was elected, he was actually on the campaign trail, and he stopped off in, I think it was Vegas, and they, in order to, you know, literally have a president in their pocket, JFK wanted a girl for the night, so they arranged a particular girl who was actually, so literally one of the mafia girls was connected with, you know, he ended up sleeping with her, and therefore there was this, he was always indebted to the mob from that time. And throughout his travels, even around the world, you know, it was common that people would connect him to, you know, a high class prostitute, basically. And in three of those cases, those women were actually connected, either highly connected, that they were feeding information either to the communists, or in either in Russia or East Germany. And so and of course there was Marilyn Monroe, of course. And Marilyn Monroe, the danger with her was that, as she described to one friend, she was discussing subjects of national security with President JFK, and then when she was in Mexico, some of her associates who were big communist leaders, she was discussing that information with them. So, you know, although he had so much to lose, even, you know, on behalf of the entire country, and even jeopardize the peace and prosperity of the entire world, still this principle will act. There is nothing that will stop it. And we see that, you see that with, you know, high profile people who are being paid millions of dollars, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they're in the public eye and they know that the whole world is watching them. You know, the soccer stars, like, what's that famous soccer star from England who married Posh Spice? Beckham. So, you know, now his affairs are coming out, you know. They have so much to lose, but they cannot stop this principle because the mind, it is just an inevitable fact that the mind will go here. What to speak of others who really have not so much to lose? See? So that is the principle. That is what, you know, even yogis, you know, and so many others. And therefore we see, you know, so many false gurus from other movements. you know, they sometimes begin as sannyasis, and then it's found that one of their disciples becomes the mother of the universe. Yeah, that they are God, and she's the mother of the universe. And then after some time, when the sexual frustration sets in and the separation, there's another mother of the universe, and that one is demoted. So these strange things go on because this principle must act. So, and here, of course, in the purport, Srila Hridayananda Maharaj gives a very nice analysis of, you know, so many problems that result, what to speak of, on an individual level, you know, a lusty person considers himself to be the enjoyer of God's creation and is therefore full of pride and false prestige. The lusty, proud person will not be attracted to the process of humble submission at the lotus feet of the bona fide spiritual master. So attraction to illicit sex is thus the direct enemy of Krishna consciousness. So of course, you know, those who succumb to this inevitable process of material reaction get entangled up in such a way that it becomes impossible for them to execute Krishna consciousness. He goes on to describe that because modern society sanctions unrestricted mixing of men and women, its citizens cannot possibly achieve peace. Rather, the regulation of conflict becomes the basis of social survival. So we see that in this world. There is no question of peace because of this principle. And the basis of social survival is just somehow or another, you know, regulating the war and the fighting and the killing, you know, as far as possible. There's no question of peace though. It's just trying to reduce the killing and the slaughter. And you know, trying to make the killing as nice as possible. So this is the symptom of an ignorant society falsely accepting the material body as the highest good, as described here by the words Vishayeshu Gunajashat. So one who is too affectionate to his own body will inevitably be seized by sex desire. So again, you know, in this second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that Indriyanam hi charitam yanmano nividhiyate tadasha hariti pragyam payonavam ivambasi. As a strong wind sweeps away a boat on the water, even one of the roaming senses on which the mind focuses can carry away a man's intelligence. So that is, Krishna is describing that it's like there was one girl who was sailing around the world recently, and was in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and a strong wind has, you know, destroyed her boat. there is nothing you can do to fight against, you know, a boat on the in the middle of the ocean, and those strong winds come and whip up the waves and what have you. It'll just smash you to pieces. And we see also there was one man who tried to row a kayak from Australia to New Zealand, and he got within about 80 miles of the coast of New Zealand, and then they heard a, you know, distress signal. You know, a strong wind had come, and that was it. You know, just wiped him out and killed him. But that is a position of the mind, you know, in the material world, which is not fixed. It doesn't have the anchor of Krishna consciousness. You know, the strong modes of material nature would just, you know, agitate the mind like a powerful wind, you know, agitating a boat on the ocean. There's nothing. The only way that you can, you know, get across that ocean is if you can hope and pray that the ocean is calm on when you're crossing. We see that even when Srila Prabhupada was crossing the ocean to come to America, and of course he had two heart attacks, and then the ocean became particularly calm, and the captain of the Jaladuta said he had never seen, you know, an ocean crossing so calm as when Prabhupada was on that boat. So, you know, by Krishna's arrangement, you know, wind and the waves and the ocean can become very calm. But similarly, one who fixes their mind on Krishna, then the modes of material nature, they become, you know, they do not react on the mind of the devotee because their mind is fixed. So, we see also in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a verse in the 5th chapter of the 1st canto, text number 14, and Narada Muni is telling Vyasadev that he is describing the defects of him having compiled so many Vedic literatures without directly helping people to fix their mind on Krishna. And he described that, you know, you are creating so many separate visions within the minds of people other than Krishna, and that just simply acts like a strong wind, you know, that's, you know, disturbing a boat which has no, you know, fixed anchor. So a similar thing there in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So actually in this purport to the Bhagavad Gita, one may think that, oh, you know, other people, you know, it happens to other people, but it won't happen to me because, you know, I'm a pretty determined fellow, and, you know, I think I can control my mind and senses, and, you know, it'll happen to someone else, but it won't happen to me. So in the Bhagavad Gita, in this, that second chapter, Srila Prabhupada gives some examples that even Lord Shiva, Lord Shiva himself, when he was agitated for sex desire by Parvati, therefore Kartikeya is a personification of anger, he was born. And we see also with Lord Brahma that there was some disturbance at one stage due to, you know, agitation. So if one is thinking, you know, that it won't happen to me, and yet it is happening even to personalities like Shiva, Brahma, Indra, there is no question, it is inevitable. But we see again in that purport to the Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada gives the example of Haridas Thakur, that he was not disturbed. So of course he is not, you know, on the level of Brahma or Shiva or some great yogi. He is simply chanting Hare Krishna. He's simply fixing his mind on Krishna. But because he's fixing his mind on Krishna, he was not disturbed even when he was tested by Maya personified. So this shows that principle that Krishna is teaching in the Bhagavad Gita in verse 61 in the second chapter, and what he's teaching here in this chapter, that, you know, religion, religious principles, without fixing their mind on hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord, inevitably leads to the calamities of falling prey to lusty desires, and that will cause calamities on the path of liberation. And of course what happens is that because people who follow different religious processes, and sometimes even Krishna consciousness, if we go through the motions of actually performing our devotional service without fixing the mind on Krishna, the same difficulty can be there. And sometimes people, even religious people, and sometimes even devotees, may therefore incorporate some philosophy that justifies their sense gratification as part of the process. I've heard, you know, several devotees say over the years that, Prabhupada gave us the four regulative principles: no intoxication, no illicit sex, no gambling, no meat eating. But, you know, realistically, no one can follow that one of no illicit sex. So, don't even, you just do what you can. I've actually heard devotees say that. But Srila Prabhupada never put it like that. He put it in other terms that, you know, there's no question of being a devotee unless you're actually following those principles. That's actually the beginning of human life, let alone being a devotee. And there's also, of course, the example of Jamunacharya, because his mind was also, he was previously engaged in the beginning of his life, he was a nice devotee, and then he actually fell down and became a king and enjoyed massive amounts of sense gratification, but he was delivered again by a devotee, and then he again fixed his mind on Krishna. And then, you know, when he remembered his previous activities as a king, you know, his lips would curl with distaste, and he would spit at the thought of, you know, of sexual pleasure. This is the the inevitable calamity of not fixing one's mind on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, hearing and chanting. And that's what Krishna is pointing out in this chapter. So therefore, the natural conclusion is, and this was explained by Narada Muni to Srila Vyasadeva, you know, is that you have to present the Srimad Bhagavatam. You have to give them the cure for this problem, and that is you have to present the Srimad Bhagavatam so that they can actually fix their mind on Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and always be able to hear and chant and perform so many different services to the Lord, you know, with their mind fixed on Krishna. And if, you know, so even if people are attached and attracted and have strong desires, material desires for things in this world, but still, as Narada Muni pointed out, that even for them, if they perform those activities which they're really strongly attached to, but at the same time they're always hearing about and chanting about Krishna, they will actually progress. They will actually progress to the platform of becoming pure bhaktas with no other material desire. But if they're following a religious process and there is no medicine of hearing and chanting about the Lord, they will actually not progress. Their religious processes, in effect, will be useless. And the knowledge and the philosophy they have, in effect, will actually be useless. So, therefore, of course, you know, Krishna appeared 5,000 years ago in order to manifest his pastimes and his personal beautiful form and the beautiful pastimes and his beautiful flute playing and his beautiful Vrindavan abode. So he actually manifested these pastimes so that we could fix our mind on the Supreme Lord as we go through our religious activities, whether we're materially attached or whether we're materially unattached, or whether we're taking to the process of devotional service. For everyone, they should hear and chant about the Lord's glories in order to actually make progress to become free from the material disease and to be reinstated in their eternal spiritual constitutional position. So it's described that Srila Prabhupada actually giving a purport to the 62nd verse of the second chapter. He described that you know, everyone is chasing the beauty in the material world, and of course, as we've described, no one, even the greatest of demigods, is free from that influence. At some stage or another, as soon as the mind is not fixed on Krishna, then that problem will arise within the mind. But the difficulty is that the beauty that we chase in the material world is actually an illusory beauty. But when the mind is not fixed on in Krishna consciousness, it is fixed in illusion. Krishna consciousness means that we see everything as it is. We become a amoghadrik, or the perfect seers. We see things properly. Whereas, you know, if we look at the beauty of this world, what is the beauty of this world? You know, just the material body is, you know, a bag of stool and pus. What other nice things we got there? We got some blood and bile, mucus. You know, if you just under the skin, you know, beauty is skin deep. Because just under there, it's not so beautiful. You know? But we forget that. it's really just a bag of stool. Therefore, sometimes you see young boys, they look at a girl and they say, "I like the way she's stacked." You know, yeah, it's a stack of stool. But, you know, they're not looking at it like that. You know, and so I'm not having a go at women. Right? Women look at men also, you know, the stack of stool. Not having a go at women. But we pointed that before, that, you know, for women, man is woman. That is the object of sense gratification for men is woman. It's the same principle. We just speak in one gender for the sake of simplicity. But, you know, so therefore, chasing beauty in the material world is actually chasing a mirage or an illusory beauty. In other words, in the desert, you see something and you chase, oh, there is water, and you chase after it, but it's just a mirage. The water's not actually there. So that mirage can't satisfy your thirst. And similarly, the beauty in the material world is a mirage. The beauty is not actually there. The beauty is somewhere else. But we chase that beauty, but it will never satisfy. But even though that, as we described, but if the mind is not fixed on Krishna, one will be swept up in that illusion, no matter how great a personality one is, and no matter how determined one thinks one is, and no matter how one is following so-called religious processes, or studying philosophy or whatever. If the mind is not fixed on the glories of the Lord, one will be swept away by that illusion and chase after that mirage. But by Krishna consciousness, one sees very clearly. And one looks, by the grace of Krishna, that which appears to be very beautiful, I see as earth, water, fire, air and ether. The material elements which will, combine together as mucus, pus and air and what have you. It is not actual beauty. So where is the real beauty? The real beauty is there in Krishna. Especially Krishna. Srila Rupa Goswami in the Nectar Devotion, he has analyzed that Krishna, if you take all the principal qualities that are possible to have in a living entity, we can divide those up into 64. And Krishna possesses those 64 qualities unlimitedly. So the living entities, or the jivas, the tiny spirit souls, they can possess the first 50 of those qualities minutely. Right? Tiny degree. So if there's some, being very intelligent, being very clever, being poetic, or different qualities like this, to some minute degree. Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, they can possess the first 55 of those qualities partially. So that there's an extra 5 qualities there manifest in Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. And the Nitya Siddha devotees, they also possess those 55 qualities. And Lord Narayan, he fully possesses the first 60 qualities. But even Krishna, he possesses those 60 qualities, but to their fullest and unlimited degree, even more so than Lord Narayan. But there are 4 other qualities which Krishna has, which is even more, which is not seen in any other living entity, even up to Lord Narayan. And those qualities are Lila Madhura, Prema Madhura, Vena Madhura, and Rupa Madhura. That Krishna possesses the quality of having uniquely attractive pastimes. So the pastimes of Lord Krishna, they're particularly sweet. And what makes the pastimes of Lord Krishna particularly sweet is that he is submissive to his devotee. So even though he's the Supreme Lord, he becomes submissive to the love of his devotees, and that makes his activities particularly sweet. So, and therefore we see that of all his different pastimes within Mathura and Dwarka and Vrindavan, the Vrindavan Leela is particularly sweet, particularly attractive, because there he is even more submissive to his devotees. And amongst the Vrajavasis, pastimes with the gopis in the Rasa Leela is the sweetest of them all, because as Krishna said, that their love for him is so elevated that he just cannot reciprocate. He cannot repay reciprocate in kind with their love. It is so elevated, and he just becomes completely purchased by their love. So that is, Krishna Prema, Prema Madhurya, Krishna's surrounded by devotees, with particularly sweet, loving relationships with the Supreme Lord. So we see even up to the Lord Narayan, there is the pastimes of with the Lord, where one is the servant, and there's a very loving reciprocation between the servant and the master. But with Krishna, he fully he is surrounded by devotees who love him as servants, friends, intimate friends, and even in a parental relationship, and even in a conjugal loving relationship. So again, amongst all those devotees who have relationship with the Supreme Lord Krishna, the gopis manifest the highest loving relationship that they love Krishna as their lover. So this is particularly unique. You don't see this with any other incarnation of the Lord, and not only do you not see it, but that quality is manifest in Krishna unlimitedly. So he has unlimited gopis and unlimited cowherd boys, unlimited different animals in the spiritual world, all reciprocating with Krishna. We see that when Krishna appeared as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he went through the Jarakanda forest, that all the animals, they were coming up and they were licking his body and smelling his beautiful, they were just in love with him. The tigers and the snakes, they just all loved him. But of all those loving relationships, that love with the gopis is so special that if they, when Krishna goes out into the pasturing ground, what to speak of being away for some time, if they just blink and they cannot see the form of that Krishna who they love so much, they're saying, what sort of person is this Brahma that has induced us to blink our eyes, and for that moment, that split second where they cannot see the object of their love becomes like 12 years. So imagine what you were doing 12 years ago, and imagine having to wait from then till now to do the next thing you want to do. That's a long time. And when they blink, it's like such, so long. Just like, you see people who go surfing. They can go for hours and hours and hours paddling in, paddling out, and they'll get out and they think, it wasn't enough time, it was like, 10 minutes. But if there's a shark in the water and they've got to swim back to the ocean, that 50-yard paddle, it just never ends. It's just like, it's taking so much time at that. So, for the gopis, when they... Hare Krishna. For the gopis, when they... If we can't hear Krishna for a second, we will all die. When the gopis, they blink their eyes, then they're feeling that it's 12 years, like, so long. Come on, eyes, open up. And if they, when they enjoyed rasa dance, of course, with Krishna, even though Krishna allowed them to, dance and enjoy with him in so many different ways, for the entire duration of the night of Brahma. That's 1,000 cycles of the four yugas, right? And they considered it's just like a moment that's just passed. It's just, why such a short time? So, the love, you can imagine that sort of love. So he is surrounded by millions of gopis with that sort of love. And of all of those gopis, the love of Srimati Radharani, that is the topmost. And therefore, Krishna appears very, very beautiful. And we see here, people come to see the form of Krishna. But especially because Radharani is standing there on Krishna's left, he appears so much more beautiful. So, this is, unique and is not found anywhere, in any other living entity or any other form of the Lord. And Venu Madhura means that Krishna has his expert playing of the flute. So Krishna is this wonderful musician. And he plays the flute so wonderfully that when he plays the flute, personalities like Lord Indra, now you can imagine in the heavenly planets that Lord Indra is a connoisseur of the best there is in the universe, right? It just the apsaras and the gandhavas and the dancing and the music that would be there in Indra's palace. So he is the connoisseur of the finest. But when Krishna plays his flute, Indra is completely bewildered as to, that which he is accustomed to becomes very, very insignificant. And Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, who are actually the source of all the musical skills within the whole universe, so that, all the wonderful musical talents and methods, they become bewildered and they bow down. But they hear Krishna playing and they just cannot fathom, they just cannot comprehend the expertise, the beauty and the wonder of Krishna's musical and artistic talent when he plays his flute. And it's so attractive. What to speak of, people who are used to, rap music and this, that and the other. And of course, if we can call it music these days, you press a button, You know, and press another button and you've got a record. And then someone who can't sing, you know, or dance, you just sort of digitally, you know, take out all the bad singing and merge it in with the music and, you know, wobble the voice a bit and it all, you know, sounds like they can sing. And then, you know, you move the cameras around in different ways and it looks like they're actually dancing. You know. But, you know, what to speak of that? Even Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, you know, cannot actually fathom. And of course, the fourth quality is, when Krishna plays his flute, the four Kumaras, who are fixed in their meditation, their meditation just breaks. You know, they are the greatest of yogis. You know, you cannot disturb them from the meditation, their samadhi. But when Krishna plays his flute, they cannot concentrate. There is no way that they can fix their mind in their meditation. And Lord Shiva, if he happens to be playing his drum, he'll just stop. He'll just put it down in frustration. You know, what am I doing? what is that crazy thing that I'm doing? You know, at this. And Krishna's beauty, Rupa Madhurya. Krishna's form, of course, is so beautiful that even Krishna himself, you know, once he saw within the jeweled palace, and he perceived his own beauty, and he's God, and he was attracted. See, I've never seen. You know, he's looking at that beauty. He thinks, I want to be Radharani. To taste that beauty. What is the value of being Krishna anymore? I want to be Radharani. So therefore, actually, Krishna, in order to taste that beauty of Krishna, and, you know, to taste that loving relationships that Radharani tastes, therefore he actually appeared as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In order to fulfill that, that was the internal desire of Lord Sri Krishna. So therefore, you know, we should be very careful. You know, don't chase the mirage of beauty in the material world, and don't make the mistake of thinking that without fixing one's mind on Krishna, that one will, you know, be able to somehow be free from that influence of chasing the mirage of, you know, beauty and happiness and sex life in the material world. But one should fix their mind on the beautiful pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and follow in the footsteps of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is teaching us how to be a devotee. And he is teaching us how to be a devotee at the very, very highest level in the mood of Srimati Radharani. Always tasting the beauty of Lord Sri Krishna. Always meditating upon the sound vibration of Krishna's flute. Always absorbed in, you know, developing that sweet, loving relationship, you know, that is as exemplified by the, you know, Brajavasis. And it's described that actually the sound of Krishna's flute is actually represented in the Hare Krishna Mahamantra. So by chanting the Hare Krishna Mahamantra, very easy way. Lord Chaitanya, he's given us such an easy way to fix the mind. You just chant Hare Krishna, and gradually, as we become more practiced to fix our mind on the name of the Lord, which itself is you know, very, very sweet, you know, a very powerful cure for the material disease. Gradually, then we naturally be able to fix our mind as we're chanting. The form of the Lord will gradually come into our mind. And gradually, as the form of the Lord, the different qualities of the Lord naturally enter our mind as we're chanting Hare Krishna and serving Krishna. And gradually, as we progress as devotees, that the pastimes of the Lord are always manifesting within our heart, within our mind. Like this, in this way, as we're chanting Hare Krishna, serving Krishna in different ways, throughout 24 hours of the day and even while sleeping, the name, the form, the pastimes, the beauty, the qualities of Krishna are just manifesting constantly within our mind and our heart. And when one is on that platform, there is no question. The material energy has no influence on such a devotee. And therefore it's described that such a devotee, that the ocean of material existence with its strong, powerful winds and, you know, big, huge waves reduces to the, you know, the water in the calf's hoofprint. A devotee just, how hard is it to step over the water contained within the hoofprint of a calf? You see that, you don't, you know, oh, look out. You know, there's a little puddle of water, and look at them big waves and that, the strong wind blowing against. You know, you just step over, you don't even look at it. You don't think twice. For a devotee fixed in Krishna consciousness, the whole material world shrinks. I have one shalagram, which is a Krishna Shila. And of course, on that, a Krishna Shila has the hoof print of a calf. And, you know, it is described that if you worship that Shila, a person who is, you know, has that fortune, that can be your last birth, of course, if you keep worshipping him. That, you know, because that calf's hoofprint symbolizes that Krishna is so kind that he's going to shrink the material ocean to that size for his devotee. So he's reminding him. So, you know, this is the process of Krishna consciousness. It makes it very, very, very easy, very sweet. But if we don't follow that, even if we're following religious processes or have some philosophy, ultimately we'll become victimized to this problem, and there is no hope of any benefit. So I'll just leave it there. If anyone has any questions or comments, just quickly. Rupa Goswami describes in the Nectar of Instruction that you know, the chanting of Hare Krishna is a medicine, and he describes it like that. You know, a patient who has jaundice, you know, such as ourselves, the medicine for jaundice is you know, there are different methods, but one also may have rock candy, and of course that rock candy or, you know, sugar tastes bitter for someone who has jaundice. So although it may be part of their cure and a barometer of their you know, how they're becoming cured, they're tasting it as bitter. But still, they actually have to go on with the medicine, and then again, that candy or rock candy become tastes sweet, and then, you know, the cure is there. And he describes if you go on chanting. So one of the things, of course, that the difficulty that why devotees may not get the full taste required by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra is to the degree that we fix our minds, you know, while we're chanting. So You know, if we're chanting Hare Krishna, but our mind is somewhere else, then, you know, we certainly don't derive the full benefit. The whole purpose of chanting Hare Krishna, of course, is to, you know, have the mind fixed on Krishna. And fixing the mind on Krishna, as we described here, is essential. Because if we follow any religious process, including Krishna consciousness, externally but without the mind fixed, you don't get the same taste and benefit. You know, as described by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, it's like having, you know, if you're rowing a boat but the anchor is still down, then, you know, you're rowing and rowing and rowing, but you don't go anywhere. So the mind still fixing on enjoying the material world, even chanting Hare Krishna, it's an anchor. And another example, of course, that Srila Prabhupada gives is that, you know, if we're cooking, you know, if you have the, you know, well, he told the story that one time there was a yogi, and the yogi, I think he had the ability to stay in the water, some like that. It was very, very cold conditions. And anyway, there was some person within the village, you know, who challenged him to, you know, prove his yogic prowess. And so I think for some time, you know, he was submerged in water, or there was some very, very cold conditions. And there was some wager that he couldn't do it. So anyway, after the yogi had successfully done that, the person refused to pay him. And he said, why is that? And he said, well, you know, you see way, way in over there, there was like, you know, a mile away or something, there's a little lamp burning on top of that house. You were drawing heat from that fire. So therefore I'm not going to pay you because you actually cheated. So then the yogi was telling, you know, was disappointed that he, you know, not so much for the reward, but the fact that, you know, here is someone cheating. And he mentioned it to the servant of this person. So this person, he was like the leader, and so he had different servants. So one day he was calling for his you know, meal, and the servant is yelling, yes, it's cooking, it's just now coming. And you know, this went on for, you know, ages, and he's thinking, you know, and he stormed in there and he said, yeah, where's the meal? He said, yeah, I'm just cooking. And he saw that you know, his servant had this, you know, fire here, and then this huge tripod, and up top there was the pot, like this. So he says, yes, I'm drawing heat from this fire, like this. So, so the, you know, the master, he understood, there's no way that you can draw heat from that fire and cook that food. So then he went and paid the yogi. So in the same way, you know, if our mind doesn't actually fix on Krishna when we're chanting and when we're serving, it's like having the fire. So we can say, I'm doing everything in Krishna consciousness, but actually you're not really drawing, you know, you're not able to. You have to put the pot right on the fire, get the real heat, and that means that the mind has to... Therefore, you know, we should always be meditating upon the, you know, the 64 qualities of Krishna, the beauty of Krishna, the pastimes of Krishna, and then where we're chanting, these things should, you know, gradually just, you know, be manifesting, you know, the our constantly hearing and chanting about Krishna. In the beginning of our devotional service, we quite often, well, it's natural that we try and perfect the process of bhakti itself. But the elevated devotees, they're perfecting the art of loving Krishna more so than the techniques of bhakti here in the tent. So we have to do both. In the beginning, we have to at least know how to execute the activities of bhakti. But there has to come a time when we're actually practicing the loving meditation on Krishna in everything we're doing. That is what the elevated devotees are doing, more so than just trying to perfect. So in the beginning, you know, we may be trying to perfect the art of playing madanga, for having good kirtan, learning the songs, you know, like that. But then, you know, when that's there, that's good. But after some time, we have to then perfect the art of singing with love for Krishna, the mind fixed with love on Krishna. If that's not there, the externals, you know, there's progress, but it is a lot slower. Any other questions? Sorry, all goes to the program.